You're listening to Chainleak, the crypto news podcast with your host, Joshua Roomsburg. Follow and subscribe today.
Welcome to the Chainleak podcast. Today's episode is about DeFi on Bitcoin, hyper-Bitcoinization, presented by Porto Finance. Today's guest, Dr. Chandra Dugarala. Welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you, Josh. Thanks for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
All right. So opening the podcast today, let's go into an introduction of Porto Finance. What are you guys building, and what is your mission?
I'll state our mission. The mission of the company since when we started is to build tools to enable hyper-Bitcoinization. And it's a vague and general statement, so let me explain. Our thesis is twofold.
Okay.
First, for Bitcoin to become money, we believe that we have to go through many more of these price spirals and speculative cycles like we've seen in 2012, 2017, 2020, 2021. And each one will be successively larger than the previous one. And the essential component of those price spirals is you need to exchange and trade Bitcoin against other cryptocurrency assets.
Okay.
Different blockchain assets, different layered assets on other blockchains, and or on Bitcoin. So what do we need to make that happen? So far, from 2012 to now, centralized exchanges have served that purpose very well, right? It's the primary source of liquidity for people to trade. Yes, that's a primary go-to tool. But as they've gotten bigger and bigger, the risks have become more and more obvious. For example, you know, the amount of money lost by centralized exchanges really spiked last year with what happened to FTX. But there's many more that are not talked about and publicized. And so centralized exchanges, we think, are kind of past their peak, and they are going down. On the other hand,
centralized exchanges are the old way of doing business.
Yes.
These days, it's more about DeFi.
It's decentralized exchanges and solutions that are trying to replace the centralized exchanges. You can look at the adoption of single chain DEXs like Uniswap. They've really taken off. More and more people come to realize the risk associated with centralized exchanges, the custodial risk, permanent loss of funds, the data leaks, privacy. All of those are a big problem in addition to the regulatory and legal problems that they face. So single chain indexes are taken off. They're doing well. The volumes are growing. But the problem still remains that there is no unifying cross-chain decentralized exchange solution.
Okay. So
that's the big reveal or part.
Do you feel your cross-chain solutions that you guys are looking to build out, do they incorporate Bitcoin into these multi-chain layers?
Absolutely. So first, we're not looking to build. We're already building, and we're almost about to release. We look at anything that you can do on Bitcoin. The general assumption that you can build it on other blockchains like Ethereum, the mirror image of that is generally true because most Turing complete chains are less restrictive than Bitcoin. Right? Bitcoin is based on a very primitive stack-based language. It's not Turing complete. So if you can build it on Bitcoin, it's more than likely that you can definitely build it on other chains. So we take Bitcoin constraints as a given, and everything else is less constraining than that. So absolutely, there are AMMs on Bitcoin, and there are counterparts on other chains.
So the way you just explained that, would you say Bitcoin is a priority starting point for building out this infrastructure?
Yes, for us, we've always taken the position that you have to build something on Bitcoin and then you can replicate its counterpart on other chains. And that's generally properties turned out to be true for us. Correct. Correct.
Okay. So let's put an emphasis on cross-chain transactions. What would that look like?
Yeah. So the ideal user experience is something that mimics a centralized exchange, something as seamless and easy as Coinbase or Binance or any of these centralized exchanges. So what do you need to have? You need to have a place to store multiple cryptocurrencies in one place without having to have 17 different wallets, right? So a multi-currency wallet where only you hold the private keys to. That's truly non-custodial, self-sovereign, self-custody. Two, the layer two cross-chain DEX solution should be seamlessly incorporated into that UX. So you don't have to transfer in and out through like layers upon layers of these DeFi solutions and then exchange this token for that and swap and then stake in somewhere, you know, and put it in a liquidity pool somewhere else. So it has to be all seamlessly included in there. And transferring coins between layer ones and layer two solutions like this should be as simple as transferring your Bitcoin and opening a Lightning channel and then settling back on chain.
Okay. Now, when you look at other products that are already on the market when it comes to cross-chain transactions and cross-chain liquidity, how do you feel you guys will stack up against what's already on the market? Do you guys have unique features?
Absolutely. So we've taken the, I mean, there are, broadly, there are not many cross-chain solutions that kind of pass the smell test. There are chains. There are chains that actually do a more, or should I say, a less centralized custody, right? Like there are there are cross-chain bridges, right?
Yep.
That's a big part of the ecosystem now. Basically, bridges are instead of having your coin sit in my wallet and then I give you your whatever the other token is, you have
one to one.
Right. You have a multi-party custody and then you issue assets against that on another chain. But there's actually no Oracle guarding the store. Okay. Basically, nobody actually says or proves to you that your assets are definitely in custody at all times and then you can redeem them one to one. So, for example, the top five bridge hacks, right? Wormhole and the other ones. Together amounted to about $1.3 to $1.5 billion worth of client fund loss, right? Just because of bridges collapsing. Yeah. Most people don't know this, but it's a proven fact. And the other solution that exists is wrapped assets, right? So you send your Bitcoin to a custodial address and a wrapped Bitcoin gets issued on the E-chain. Again, similar problem. There are no security guarantees that the asset is actually backed at all times and is fully redeemable, right? Wrapped coins are an issue. The fact that they kind of trade close to the native asset is not really proof of anything because the security properties are very different. You know, native Bitcoin versus wrapped BTC.
How does Portal guarantee the asset is still there on chain?
Right. So if you take away the bridges and if wrapping and synthetics, the only thing that is left is atomic swaps. And that's what we've decided to use right from the beginning. We focused on building atomic swap based solutions. And atomic swap basically is, I'll describe layer one and then the difference between layer one and layer two. Layer one atomic swaps. So let's say you are somewhere in France, right? And I am in I'm in Tokyo, you know. And you want to send me some Bitcoin. I want to send you some ETH. We both met somewhere. We agreed on an exchange price, and then I say, "Hey, Josh, send me your Bitcoin, and then I'll send you my ETH." Right? And you send me your Bitcoin, and then I do nothing and disappear. That's a problem. If you do it in the reverse order, you'll face the same problem. Right, or I'll face the same problem. So this is called the fair exchange problem. There's kind of an informal proof back in the late 1990s in computer science about this. So atomic swaps solve this problem by assuming that the underlying blockchains follow the predetermined rules. So what I do is I write a contract that says you can take these coins that are locked up in the contract, but for you to do this, you have to reveal a specific piece of information. And then when you do, within a certain time frame, I can take that piece of information, then I can get your coins that you locked up in a almost mirror image contract on another chain.
Okay. Right?
So what atomic refers to is that the entire transaction either happens or none of it happens, right? So you can't deconstruct it any further. So it is atomic in the sense that I get your Bitcoin, you get my ETH. So that's the basis of an atomic swap. That's a layer one atomic swap. But they are troublesome in the sense that, you know, I have to wait for confirmations, which takes time. I have to pay transaction fees, which is expensive. And so people really never use atomic swaps, although theoretically they've been possible since at least 2013, 2014. Because the user experience is a nightmare. They're slow, they're expensive, and nobody likes them. But what you can do with what we're doing is layer two atomic swaps, in the sense that just like Lightning, if you're familiar with Lightning, most of what you do by adjusting the channel balances as to who owns how many coins is not settled on chain. We basically update balances. But given a certain way of constructing the contracts and certain guarantees that depend on the underlying hash functions not being broken, you can trust that you can always close your account or channel, and then you can always get your coins back on layer one and have them back in your wallet, right? It doesn't depend on trusting me. It doesn't depend on trusting a third party. It basically depends on trusting the core crypto primitives underlying.
When you mention the Lightning Network, is it a similar concept to where you put your tokens in and they're basically in a basket for anybody to use at any time?
I would say the opposite, in the sense that you and I can basically move our respective coins to this layer two. Yep. And then we can trade without having to settle on chain. The analogy is, let's say you moved your coins to a centralized exchange and I move my coins to a centralized exchange and we are both trading against each other, right?
Yeah.
We're not actually settling them on chain. What the UX shows you is the database entries are recorded in the ledger of the centralized exchange. It's basically entries as to who owns what and what's the balance in each account. But it's not settled on chain. When you want to withdraw, that's when they send you your coins, and then you get them back in your wallet. It's very similar to that, except there's nobody in the middle.
That's what I was trying to get at, is the way it's forming in my head, and I hope this is right, is it would be however many Bitcoin sitting in a specific, is it a contract or something? But it's in one contract, and off chain or on chain, everybody has the information on how many Bitcoin each person owns, but they could do the transactions off chain and it gets deducted from that main balance.
Close. So the coins in the contract are the balance of the coins in the contract can be checked by anybody, right?
Yeah.
Any client can parse this, client meaning the software on your device. The balances as to who is owed what is apparent to you and to me. When we close that channel, your Bitcoin goes to me, my ETH goes to you, and we settle. Right. Until that point, they sit in something that can be thought of as an escrow contract, but there's nobody holding it. Right. It's basically the blockchain itself is the counterpart.
So it's basically an escrow smart contract.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very useful way to think about it.
Yeah, that was a lot to wrap your head around. A lot of people that are new to the industry might not necessarily understand that concept. Is there any way to make what we just talked about shorter and easier to understand for an end user who might be new?
Thinking visually, I would say, imagine all of the functionality of a centralized exchange, right? But yep. The experience is built into your wallet. So you don't have to log in. You don't have to do two-factor auth. You don't have to get the receiver address from the centralized exchange. You don't have to go into your wallet, do the transfer, wait for confirmations. Imagine that that's all done through your wallet. And most that's of these operations cool. happen in the background. And then you just see your balance in your wallet. You know, what's on layer one, what's locked in the DEX layer two. And then other balances of other tokens that you are exchanging for.
Okay.
And then you can settle them up and bring them back to layer one. It's all seamless and from one place. That's the gold standard.
Okay. Now moving forward, what do you feel is Portal Finance's main focus? How do you guys play into the Bitcoin ecosystem?
I would say Bitcoin is an extensible monetary layer. So if you look at the real world, you see cash, right? That's basically the money, base yep. money. And there are layers of monies with different monetary properties, like high liquidity, high redeemability, like, for example, like savings deposits. And then there are, you know, there's layers upon layers of value, right? There are contracts, there are bonds, there is debt. All of those things we built on top of Bitcoin. So Portal is yep. a layered value add on top of Bitcoin. Because you can say, okay, what is the current use case for Bitcoin? It's transfer value.
And store of value.
Yes, some people definitely do store long-term, you know, store their wealth in Bitcoin for the long-term. Many people trade. And I actually think that trade is the primary use case for the conceivable future. And as okay. Bitcoin becomes money, it just becomes a generally accepted medium of exchange. And then I'd be buying coffee with it. And, you know, you'd be getting paid in Bitcoin. Until that happens, you know, you have to go through this phase where the primary utility is transfer and exchange and storage.
What do you think it takes for Bitcoin to hit that plateau where we start using Bitcoin for everyday transactions? Is it a higher price point, or is it about wider adoption? Do you see Bitcoin being 8 Satoshis for a coffee? I mean, something like that. Is that what you see for the future?
Definitely that is the goal. So I'll answer your first question first in terms of okay. what is needed before Bitcoin becomes the currency of daily transactions, generally accepted medium of exchange. I think the number one hindrance to that is volatility. Let's assume that you have a coffee shop, right? And I'm paying for coffee. If all of our accounting and our profit and loss is done in another denomination like the USD, right? Like fiat currency.
Yep.
And you have to pay your suppliers in fiat. Your obligations are denominated in fiat, meaning like you have to pay your employees in fiat, you have to pay your rent in fiat, all that stuff. And then I come in yeah. and I tell you, I'll pay you in Bitcoin. You have a problem, right? You have the problem of how much did I pay by the time you actually liquidate it and you pay off your obligations? Is it $4 or is it six or is it two? You have okay. no idea, right? And I have no yeah. idea if I overpaid for coffee or if I got a steal. So it's a two-sided problem of where, you know, the volatility is a killer. So that's why we don't use it in daily exchange, because you can't, unless it's the unit of account, it's an additional problem for you to manage on your on your P&L and for me as well. When will that go away? I think it'll take many more of these cycles, these speculative cycles like 2012, 2017, 2020. Given the supply being fixed and the origination actually goes down every 4 years, as more and more people come in, the spirals and the price spirals would be much more violent and bigger. At some point, it'll cross the threshold of, you know, it flips, hyper-Bitcoinization happens, people stop using fiat, and they just start using Bitcoin. When that is, I can't tell you. I actually don't think it's very close or near. But it's definitely...
Do you feel the ETFs that are being projected, and some have already been launched around the world so far, they're brand new on the market, but do you think the ETFs will play a role in the next level of Bitcoin, reaching that next level?
Oh, 100%. I think they are, they're going to definitely drive adoption, in the sense that if you're a registered investment advisor or a wealth manager, you can't tell your clients now that you're going to buy and hold Bitcoin, because you don't have, first of all, there are not many qualified custodians that'll do that for you. Right. Two, you don't have the legal immunity or shield that comes from actually buying a BlackRock ETF if you went on Coinbase and bought some for your clients, right?
Right.
Your legal risks are high. So having an ETF is definitely going to make it more accessible. More investment advisors, I suspect, will start making it a part of portfolio for their clients, which drives adoption, which drives price, given that the supply is fixed. Oh, it's absolutely a net positive. Is there a downside? Yes, there's definitely a downside. Anytime big institutions get to buy and hold a lot of Bitcoin, they can potentially exert influence on at least the publicly listed miners, right?
Yeah.
They can impose restrictions. They can do transaction censorship. They can do all sorts of things. So it's got a definite downside. But where will it? I think on net, having more people being able to buy and hold through their accounts is a net positive.
Like I was thinking wealth managers at, say, Chase or Bank of America, they would be able to do it for the retail customers there that are high net worth individuals?
I think if the ETF is issued or the ETF is by an institution like Vanguard or Fidelity or BlackRock, they'll feel much more comfortable doing that.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And I do talk to registered investment advisors and wealth managers, and we can try and get a sense of where the pulse is. Absolutely, it's much more comfortable for them.
So the biggest aspect right now holding us back from the next level of mass adoption is it always comes back to the clarity in these ETFs and the different safeguards for the different people to manage their wealth. All that comes into play when you think about the next chapter for this industry. We need to have a lot more safeguards available, not only for end users and retail, but you need it for institutions as well. Because an institution isn't going to put up $100 million if there's a lot of risk involved. The way I look at it. So when you think about that, how does Portal play a role in that? In the future, could you see institutions using your software in programming?
I can't say at this moment, especially with regards to the cross-chain DEX, because the legal requirement, this was built for self-sovereign operations, right? This was designed for anybody with access to the internet and minimum level of hardware to be able to do it. if you do have many more layers of custodians, legal compliance requirements, that's kind of not the focus of what we're doing. Okay. I think it's absolutely essential, but I don't see a lot of wealth managers and investment advisors actually trading. Right? Because it's buy and hold strategy, very similar to when you go to an investment advisor, they'll tell you to buy BlackRock large cap ETF or whatever. They buy hold.
Now, the next angle to put a twist on that, when you look at a retail user and the type of transactions they could do, it could be 500, 1,000, 5,000. What do you think that cap is for a retail user?
For a single retail user using the layer two swaps approach, I mean, there's really, it's limited by bandwidth, right? It's like how many messages can you pass? How much liquidity is there in the system? How many counterparties are available peer-to-peer? That's the constraint. It's kind of like lightning in the sense. Practically, there are channel capacity limitations, but in theory, as the network grows, the upper bound is probably above your threshold of how many you would or could do.
Okay. Because I was looking at
the practical limitation is more your time and your decision making. It's not the bandwidth.
I was thinking more a user wants to come on your platform and do $1 million or a $5 million transaction. Would they be able to do that, or would they be waiting to find something else on the other end to trade with?
Absolutely. You know, there's two restrictions. So you can't have low liquidity and low slippage, right? Like if you have low liquidity, you will have slippage. If there's a lot of liquidity, high slippage. If you have a lot of liquidity, you'll have a lot less of this. Those constraints will still exist because you ultimately are trading against a pool of liquidity. So getting more and more liquidity, more and more users, more and more crypto money institutions is absolutely essential. The second part of your question is this comes down to, let's say I did a $100 million transfer of Bitcoin. When is it confirmed? There's no such thing, sadly. Because that's just the nature of the protocol, in the sense that you have to assess how many confirmations, how much block reward these miners are getting, what are the balance of incentives if they do reverse this and fork it and go through a different history of the chain, how much are they? It gets complex, but we don't typically trade. You know, nobody trades tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in single trades anyway.
Not regular people. So the next angle I want to take with this is when you look at retail versus institution, you say your products are built for retail users?
Self-sovereign users.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the liquidity pools, who could you see as your ideal user putting into them liquidity pools to help build it up? Do you see it as a group of users?
So one of the things that we are solving is aggregation of liquidity across different users and different types of users. If there is fragmented liquidity, if there is, you know, one way in which institutions with more than $1 million dollars or so can do, and there's a different one for retail, that's just a problem. Fragmentation of liquidity is not good. But if all of the liquidity can be aggregated into these time-based pools, then everybody benefits. All of the counterparties benefit. So being an LP is not restricted by the type of user, ideally. And anybody can just join and add their liquidity.
Okay. Now, are there any benefits for adding liquidity to the protocol?
Absolutely. So the goal of the design is to make sure that the fees coming from all of this exchange activity, right, the peer-to-peer exchange activity, is captured and then transferred to the people who perform that essential function, basically, like locking up liquidity, like when you're providing Lightning intermediate liquidity solutions.
Yeah.
You're getting paid. I mean, the problem is it's very similar to think about, except that Lightning is a lot less used than cross-chain exchange.
Right, for sure. Especially in 2023, DeFi seems to have captured the entire industry right now. Now, when you look forward to 2024 and 2025, where do you see the future of Porto Finance?
We will be post-product release. We will be obviously continuing to develop products supporting the DEX protocol, you know, technical help, engineering, all that stuff. But we actually have more not than just the DEX protocol, right? Like there's the wallet. There are tools to actually connect your crypto to autonomous financial agents. That's another big thing that we're working on, which, you know, is not that far off. It's very, very close. All of these things, you know, one of the things that we've done is we took the opposite approach of most public projects, you know, that we are a company developing software that will eventually be open sourced. Most projects will try to build in the open from day one. We've taken the opposite approach because most of the team comes from traditional Silicon Valley startups where you actually build with focus and in isolation, and then you make it public, and then you iterate. We've taken that approach. In 2024, we'll definitely be on the later part of that that journey. There'll be a lot of iteration, product improvement, and support.
Are you guys looking to launch any products this year?
Absolutely, yes. Yes,
within the next three.
Yeah, so right now we are testing and integrating with single chain DEXs and marketplaces.
Okay.
The Portal's own wallet will be released in the next several months, but that is not the only wallet, right? Like our goal is to make sure that the protocol is integrated into as many wallets out there as possible.
Okay. That's
right?
Cool.
Because it's not just our wallet. And support as many single chain DEXs as possible. So they can actually provide seamless access to Bitcoin user base. Into
and
their
open up with the partnerships.
Correct,
I like that.
Correct. Exactly. And then there are AI tools, you know, some of which are in the market, but we haven't made a big news out of publicizing that because they're under constant improvement. So yeah.
Okay.
Lot coming. Will it nicely line up with the next macro interest in Bitcoin? You shall see.
That'd be nice to see, right? Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add to conclude the interview today?
The one thing I would say is follow Portal_finance on Twitter. If you want to keep up to date on all of the happenings, all of the product updates, everything that's happening with Portal ecosystem. And
give them your website.
We are portaldefi.com.
Okay. And then your Twitter account?
At Portal_finance. My personal Twitter account is at CSENTROPY. CS Entropy.
Okay. And then I appreciate you being on the show today. This has been Porto Finance, building DeFi on Bitcoin, hyper-Bitcoinization. Thank you for being here, brother. Have a good day.